of God this morning, I want to further outline for you what the elders had decided would happen here for in terms of reading the Bible through the summer. Summer meaning particularly the months of July and August. We have spent a lot of time in the Old Testament, 9 months in fact, and hopefully you've had the benefit not only of reading it and discussing it in groups together, but also hearing it taught from the pulpit from whoever may be speaking on a Sunday morning. But the elders have recognized that most groups have all but shut down for the summer, and so learning together in community, which has been a really high value as we have listened, will not be happening until groups kick off again in the fall. We also recognize the essential nature of the Gospels and New Testament to our faith because we are a New Testament church, and these would be studied during the summer when people are on vacation and so maximum benefit would not be had. And so we're going with a reading program that has two options this summer. The recommended program, which maybe you can see, oh, it's smaller detail. I'll let you know what that's all about anyway. I've called it the Superfood Bible Reading Program, which is just staying on the Read the Bible for Life schedule as is. I've labeled it superfood because it gives you important spiritual ingredients, the veggies, the antioxidants that will help fight disease in your spirit as it would in your body. That is the preferred option. If you are caught up or close to being caught up, that is the option we would encourage you to pursue for the summer. But we also understand that there are a lot of people who are behind and will be away, etc., during the summer, and that the discipline may not be as it ought to be or as it has been throughout the year. And so we've invented a reading schedule that is called the Required Daily Intake Schedule, which I think is just... It involves the minimum amount of various foods that it would need to keep you alive. This plan is different from the first plan in that it will focus on reading the Gospels through the summer. And whereas the RBL plan has you read all four Gospels through the summer and even move on into Corinthians, up to Corinthians, we've just taken the Gospels of Matthew first and Luke second, and you're reading the approximately a chapter a day. Okay, so Matthew 1 for July 1st, Matthew 2 for July 2nd. When you get to Matthew 4, it's 4:1 to 22 and 3:54 to 56. But it's about the equivalent of a chapter a day. And it takes you through the Gospels in the summer, through two of the four rather than all four. The second way that you can do the required daily intake plan is not just to read the Gospels, but if you're far behind, like 2 months behind or more, you can use that time to catch up to where you should be and where your conscience tells you that you should be. Now, what we want to do is that at the end of the summer, we're going to reset and read through the Gospels again, following the Read the Bible for Life program, you know, that set of readings, to be able to benefit together in groups, which will have started again, with pulpit support from wherever that comes from. And because we are a New Testament community, it is important that we study the Gospels in the New Testament where there are the most people here and the most benefit to be had. This will allow us to spend time when everyone is here, more or less. Everyone is engaged in the New Testament, because it has been a long time coming, and some of you are longing for that to happen. And this will mean that the initiative itself will be finished come Advent time, okay? About the end of November, we'll be done reading through the Bible, and then we'll have a different focus in the new year. Our hope in these two plans is that no matter which one you choose one and stick to it. Because the major goal of the elders when we instituted this a year ago or more, well, not quite a year ago, was that every person would get the discipline of being in the Bible every day. That it doesn't matter if you read through all the RBL stuff, but you're in there every day, whether you read a chapter or whether you read four. So hopefully between these two plans, you'll be able to maintain the discipline that is so important for our spiritual health. Okay. Oh, and these will be available next week. Copies of both will be in the bulletin next week, so you can take one or the other or both, pray it through, and pick the one that you want to do for the summer, and then stick with it. And in the following weeks, they'll be available at the information center. Okay? Good. I want to show you a commercial that perhaps you have seen in the last week or so if you have watched hockey playoffs. If we can get it to work, there it is.
When thunderstorms intensify, when wind turns deadly, or when a child has been abducted, remember this. The new Alberta Emergency Alert. Stop, listen, respond. It can save lives.
You seen that commercial? Yeah? No? You alive? Yes? Okay, you're alive. Have you seen the commercial? Yes. You should have if you haven't. Watch hockey, then you will. The advantage of an emergency alert program was brought front and center because of the horrible earthquake that happened in Moore, Oklahoma on May 20th. Actually, according to the National Weather Service, Moore was among one of the first cities in the United States to be certified as storm ready in 2001. And that designation was actually renewed last year, a renewal that requires the government to have multiple ways to let people know of coming danger. So that in the case of Moore, once the warning was received, the residents actually had 36 minutes to prepare for that storm. If this had happened in the 1990s, they would have had 5 minutes to prepare. Moore sounded, what they had there is they've got 36 of these tornado warning sirens that they sounded 3 times before the twister hit. And had the city activated what is called their red code, which I'm not sure why they did not, but they didn't, the system actually exists to phone people's phones, to send out emails, to send text messages to warn them about the storm that is coming. Incredibly intricate and overlapping warning systems that led to tens rather than hundreds of people being killed. Still incredibly tragic, but it would have been much worse were it not for this system of warnings. It's probably been just in the last 50 to 100 years that technology has aided us in warning others in this way of impending danger. Before that, the most technologically advanced warning systems was certainly not email or a blurb across your television screen or a text message sent to you, but maybe a smoke from a fire somewhere, or a shot that's fired off, or the ringing of bells, those sorts of things, but nothing technologically advanced like we have now. The times that we've been looking at in the Old Testament when prophets prowled the earth, about the only warning systems that they had for danger would be a human voice announcing and then perhaps sounding a horn. In the material that you're going to read this week, you will notice that God calls one who sees and hears and then passes on a warning to others, a watchman. It's based on the image or the model of a watchman that would stand on the wall of a city and would be charged with watching for enemies approaching. And should they see an enemy approaching, or they see the dust cloud that would mean horses, or they hear the hooves, they would yell out and sound an alarm, and the men would take up defensive positions, and the gates of the city would be closed. The women and children would be put in the safest place that they could find. But all of it would begin with the warning from a watchman. Example of this working in one form is in 2 Samuel 18. Joab, David's commanding general, is sending word back to David in Jerusalem that his son has been killed. David is sitting between the two gates, obviously waiting for news of what was happening there. And verse 24 says, "And a watchman went up to the roof by the wall and raised his eyes and looked, and behold, a man running by himself. And he goes and tells the king. Then the watchman saw another man running, and he called to the gatekeeper, behold, there's another man running by himself. Two messengers coming, neither of which were bearing the news that David wanted to hear, but David had been warned well in advance of their approach because the watchman had done his job and done it well. God mentions this as a part of Ezekiel's role early in the book in chapter 3, verses 18 to 21, which I'll refer to a bit today. But the main text that I want us to look at is his second calling of Ezekiel to be a watchman in chapter 33. And the reason why that is so important for us as New Testament believers to understand is because what God commissioned one man, Ezekiel, to do in his time back then, he has charged us with as New Testament believers to do in our age today. We have New Testament examples to follow. John the Baptist, who warned. Jesus, who warned. The apostles, who both in the book of Acts and the things that they say, and in their books and the things that they write, warned. Paul mentions a specific instance of this in 2 Thessalonians 3:14. He said, if anyone does not obey our instruction in this letter, take special note of that person and do not associate with them. Yet do not regard them as an enemy, but warn him as a brother. We, as Ezekiel was called in the Old Testament, have been called to be watchmen and to warn as disciples. But what does that entail? What is that all about, to be a watch person today as disciples? I want us to turn to Ezekiel chapter 33 and read verses 1 to 9 together and explore what's all involved in this watchman or watchwoman business. So if you'd stand and read with me, Ezekiel 33, 1 to 9. And the word of the Lord came to me, saying, Son of man, speak to the sons of your people and say to them, if I bring a sword upon a land, and the people of the land take one man among them and make them their watchman, and he sees the sword coming upon the land and blows the trumpet and warns the people, then he who hears the sound of the trumpet does not take warning, a sword comes and takes him away, his blood will be on his own head. He heard the sound of the trumpet, but did not take the warning. His blood will be on himself. But had he taken the warning, he would have delivered his life. But if the watchman sees a sword coming and does not blow the trumpet, and the people are not warned, and a sword comes and takes a person from them, he is taken away in his iniquity, but his blood will be required from the hand of the watchman. Now as for you, son of man, I have appointed you as a watchman for the house of Israel. So you will hear a message from my mouth and will give them warning from me. When I say to the wicked, O wicked man, you will surely die, and you do not speak to warn the wicked from his way, that wicked man will die in his iniquity, but his blood will be required from your hand. But if you on your part warn a wicked man to turn from his way, and he does not turn from his way, he will die in his iniquity, but you have delivered your life. And this is the word of God. As you can tell from what we read, there are two parties that participate in this warning process, the watchman and the one being warned. I want us to think about them one at a time, beginning with the watchman or woman. God said to Ezekiel way back in chapter 3, verse 17, Son of man, I've appointed you a watchman over the house of Israel. Whenever you hear a word from my mouth, warn them from me. And what we read in verse 2, God fleshes it out even more in this chapter 33. Son of man, speak to the sons of your people and say to them, if I bring a sword upon the land and the people of the land take one man from among them and make him their watchman, He sees a sword coming on the land, and he blows the trumpet and warns the people. Now that's a faithful watchman, seeing the approaching danger and warning people. A watchman is charged to faithfully and accurately pass on the responsibility for responding to danger onto the individual who hears. I want to play you an odd example of that. It's actually a commercial that, a drug commercial that I can actually show in church for Lipitor. Okay?
Talk about a wake-up call. I had a heart attack at 57. My doctor told me I should have been doing more for my high cholesterol. What was I thinking? But now, I trust my heart to Lipitor.
When diet and exercise are not enough, adding Lipitor may help. Unlike some other cholesterol-lowering medications, Lipitor is FDA-approved to reduce the risk of heart attack, stroke, and certain kinds of heart surgeries if you have several common risk factors or heart disease. Lipitor has been extensively studied with over 16 years of research. Lipitor is not for everyone, including people with liver problems and women who are nursing, pregnant, or may become pregnant. You need simple blood tests to check for liver problems. Tell your doctor if you are taking other medications or if you have any muscle pain or weakness. This may be a sign of a rare but serious side effect.
I learned the hard way, but you may be able to do something.
Have a heart-to-heart with your doctor about your risk and about Lipitor.
Did you catch the warnings? I timed the warnings. It was a 60-second commercial. There were 20 seconds worth of warnings. Why did they add that? Well, of course, it's to cover their rear ends, bottom line. We know that, so that they don't get sued. But it's also to pass along a warning to you that shifts the responsibility for action off of them and onto you. That's what a watchman does, a shifting of responsibility from himself onto you, not as a way to pass off blame and be guilt-free, but as a way of shifting responsibility onto the person for whom it belongs, which is the one who hears. Now we see two responses to this call to be a watchman in Ezekiel. The first response is to faithfully pass on the message. God says in verse 3 that if the watchman sees and sounds the alarm, etc., that his role has been fulfilled because that responsibility has been shifted off of him and on to the hearer. Though he may still care deeply for the person or persons involved, he is no longer responsible. That's being faithful. And yet, as God explains to Ezekiel the role of a watchman, he also acknowledges that not every watchman is faithful, that there are negligent watchmen and women as well, showing up late, sleeping on the job, reading the newspaper when they should be watching for and listening for signs of danger. He says in verse 6, if a watchman sees the sword coming and does not blow the trumpet, then the people are not warned. And the sword comes and takes the person from them, not the watchman, but the person is taken away in his iniquity. That's interesting. So we're talking about judgment here. Notice how everything he says here has to do with sin. It doesn't say if the watchman fails to sound the horn and the person is taken away in his bed or on his horse or in her house, but in their iniquity. So we're not talking about their physical location at the time of death. We are talking about their spiritual condition at the time of death. The unwarned will perish in their iniquity, in their sin. Notice, secondly, at the end of the sentence, the result of the negligent watchman who does not warn and pass on the message. It says that the dead person's blood will be required from the watchman's hand. Why blood? What's the deal with the blood? Well, way back in Genesis 9, verse 5, God says to Noah, "Surely I will require your lifeblood from every beast, I will require it. And from every man and every man's brother I will require the life of man. What's he talking about? Next verse. Whoever sheds a man's blood, which in this case would include an animal, by man his blood shall be shed, because in the image of God he made man. God is saying that because man has been made in his image, and the life of one created in the image of God is in their blood, to therefore shed blood is to sin against God who created this person in his image. Obviously, Genesis is referring to active killing. Someone goes out and murders another, or an animal rips somebody to pieces. But what God makes clear in our text in Ezekiel is that death for which the negligent watchman or watchwoman is held accountable may not be active murder, but passive murder. Failing to warn about impending danger and doom makes you as a watchman responsible, almost as if you had committed the murder. Passivity, apathy, negligence, procrastination as capital offenses if we fail to warn those who are perishing. So we must warn, because it is a matter of sin not to. Now, this is especially challenging in Canada. We know that because Canadians are private people. We mind our own business and mind a lot if others try to do so as well. We don't want to talk about religion. You go to the States, there's not a problem. It's amazing, the difference. I have a friend who was a chaplain in the Canadian Forces for 4 years. And he said that they had conversational rules for the mess hall, and that there were three things that you could not talk about. You could not talk about politics, you could not talk about religion, and you could not talk about someone else's wife. Because conversation about any or all of these things would undoubtedly lead to fights. And yet we've been called to be watchmen and women, to talk about religion, even to warn against judgment. But perhaps it's how it's done that makes all the difference in the world. Being those who faithfully and tactfully warn those with whom we have a trusted relationship about the judgment to come and how to avoid being swept away by it. When that kind of a warning is carefully and lovingly spoken, perhaps more than on one occasion, you've been faithful. It doesn't mean that you wipe the dust off your hands and that you're no longer responsible, that you don't do it more than once, but it does mean that you have been carefully faithful, understanding the culture and the responsibility. Now, just as there are two responses to the watchman seeing a warning, that of faithfulness and that of unfaithfulness, there are also two responses of the person who hears the warning. The first of those responses of one who hears the warning is actually back in chapter 3, where God first calls Ezekiel to be a watchman. And here he talks about a formerly righteous man who takes an off-ramp into iniquity, into sin. I'm assuming that it's not just once, but it's a lifestyle of sin. And God says to Ezekiel in chapter 3, verse 21, if you've warned the righteous man that the righteous should not sin, and he does not sin, which means that there's a change of behavior because the warning is heard and heeded, he will live because he took your warning, and you've delivered yourself from responsibility as well. James says in chapter 5 of his book, if you still wonder whether this is a New Testament thing or not, my brethren, if any among you strays from the truth and one turns him back, let him know that he who turns a sinner from the error of his ways will save his soul from death and cover a multitude of sins. In order to turn someone back, you have to warn them. If you keep on going the way you're going, this is what's going to happen. And on occasion, that will lead to someone coming to Christ or repenting of their sin, which is the response we want and pray for. The second response is a tragic one. It may be the one that we're used to receiving. If we have shared Christ with someone and they have refused, or we have had a brother and sister or sister in the Lord walk away and ignore the warnings that we have carefully and lovingly given. Verse 8 says, "If I say to the wicked, O wicked man, you shall surely die. And you as the watchman," verse 9, "warn a wicked man to turn from his ways, and he does not turn from his ways, he will die in his iniquity." That is the problem of the unrepentant person who is judged by Christ. In his autobiography that was turned into a movie, A River Runs Through It, Norman McLean tells the story of his family, especially the story of he and his brother Paul growing up in rural Montana in the 1920s and 30s. His parents had actually migrated down from Nova Scotia to Missoula, Montana, where he became the Presbyterian minister there. It became obvious early on that Norman's younger brother, Paul, on your right, had a self-destructive, rebellious streak in him. When he graduated from college, he came back and wrote for the local newspaper. He drank and smoked heavily, gambled excessively and badly. His parents obviously disapproved of his lifestyle, but he wouldn't listen to them. Norman came back from school at Dartmouth College, and he saw what his brother was doing, and he tried to give him money to get out of debt. He tried to get him out of the poker game he was involved with. He tried to warn him that if he kept on hanging around with this crowd and living the lifestyle that he did, that he was going to die. Paul refused any advice or help that was offered. He just thanked his older brother for caring. And then the day came when Paul was found beaten to death with the butt end of a revolver at the in a back alley of Missoula, Montana, probably for bad and unpaid debt. First, they had broken all of the bones in his right hand, the hand he used to make his living with as he wrote, the hand that he would deal cards with, and the hand that he used to fly fish with extraordinary skill. Norman writes, "These were the words of my father's last sermon not long before his own death. Each of us here today will at one time or another come upon a loved one in need and ask the question, 'We're willing to help, Lord, but what, if anything, is needed?' It is true that we can seldom help those closest to us. Sometimes we don't know what part of ourselves to give, but more often that part we do have is not wanted. We are led by God to speak to them, and we do, and the warning, though heard, is unheeded. And it is agonizing to see them walking away, isn't it? It's the problem of the unrepentant person. And sometimes we just don't know what to do about that. But then I suppose there was the time or times when we did know what to do about it, when God had told us to speak to someone and we did not. That's not the problem of the unrepentant person. That's the problem of the irresponsible watchman. As many of you may know, Oskar Schindler was a German industrialist who manufactured enamelware pots and pans during World War II under contract with the German government. Some of his story is portrayed in Schindler's List. There he is shown to utilize Jewish slave labor to make his stuff, for which he paid basically nothing and so operated his business almost at a total profit. And he lived an unbelievably lavish lifestyle while those who slaved for him lived in squalor. And yet as time went on and a number of circumstances came into his life, Schindler became more and more compassionate in his thinking and actions towards the Jews who slaved for him in his factory. His lavish lifestyle didn't change, but he cared about the Jews more and more. Finally, after witnessing a massacre and coming to understand the true nature of the camps like Auschwitz, he was so moved by the plight of these people that he, along with his accountant, made up a list of names of people whom he would purchase back from the Germans with his own money. He would buy back their lives. And he did. The day the announcement was made by Winston Churchill that the Germans had surrendered, Schindler knew that he had to flee because he had profiteered from slave labor, which was and still is a criminal war crime. And as he walked out of the compound, Itzhak Stern, who was the little guy here who was at the typewriter and his accountant for a long time, presented him with a ring that was made from gold fillings taken from some of the teeth of those whose freedom he had purchased. And engraved on that ring were words from the Talmud that says, "He who saves one life saves the world entire." And as he shook hands with Stern, the enormity of what he could have done overwhelmed him. He said, "I could have made more money. I wasted so much money, you have no idea. This car, why did I keep this car? It was 10 more people." Took off his Nazi pin and said, "This pin, two more people, this is gold. He would have given me at least one more person. I could have got one more person, and I didn't." And he fell to the ground sobbing at what he could have and should have done. Now, I cannot read these passages from Ezekiel or see this scene from the movie without remembering the number of people that God has asked me to talk to and to warn. But I was too busy or too comfortable or too afraid or just too lazy to do it. Now they may well be in hell. And I realize that I could have got one more person. But I didn't. It's awful comfort, but I'm not alone in this, am I? Too many times in my life, God has asked me to do this, and I have not done it. Too many times I have had to ask for forgiveness for being a negligent watchman. And yes, He forgives. But it's not like a cloth that removes all of the writing from the whiteboard. It doesn't take away the knowledge of knowing where these people are potentially spending their eternity because of your disobedience. What it does is it restores your relationship with Him and gives determination and courage to speak next time He asks you to. "Oh, your sins be as scarlet and your hands red with blood, you can be white as snow because of the forgiveness that Christ offers." I want us to take a few minutes before we take communion together and have you ask God three things. The first one being this: if necessary, "God, forgive me for the times when I've been unfaithful." And as a way to continue to try and be faithful, "Guide me to the person or persons with whom you would want me to share." And you know what? Write that name down somewhere conspicuous. I don't care if it's on your forehead. Don't say, "I just remember." No, you won't. Write it down in a place that you will consistently see it. And third, ask for the equipping that you need God, please grant me the courage I need, the words I lack, the love I'm short on, to tenderly and accurately share your message. Take a few minutes, and then I will pray for the elements of communion, and then we will take it together.